Emily. She wanted to know which relatives he had spoken to, showing particular interest in Travis's grandmother, Norma Sarvey. She'd already told Flores about Travis's close relationship with his grandmother, who had raised him since he was a boy. It was as if she wanted Flores to see how close her relationship with Travis had been, otherwise she wouldn't know so much about his family and those closest to him. She even went so far as to ask if Flores would be willing to deliver a message from her to them. "I'll let you decide what to say, and I'll relay it exactly how you want me to," he assured her. His willingness to oblige her desire to reach out to the family seemed a calculated effort to gain her trust. As frustrating as it must have been to indulge Arias's many deflections, I admired Detective Flores's single-mindedness as he pressed on. "So were you there that day? Please tell me. Did you just miss him? Did he call you? Did he miss you? The only explanation I can think of is that you went there for one purpose, and that's to hurt him. Were you guys alone? Answer that for me. Should I be looking for somebody else? Was there anybody else with you besides you and Travis? Are you protecting somebody else?" Flores's questions were met with a lengthy silence. "Jody?"
"I'm sorry, I just don't know what to do. I'm just trying to figure things out."
It was obvious by her statement that she was trying to work out a new story and buying time so she could concoct it. Arias maintained that it was all blur before again requesting to see the photos to help her bring it into focus. Flores didn't close off the possibility, telling her detectives had taken them to Reading when they went to pick up the rental car, and that perhaps she could view them once the investigators returned to Wairika.
"Oh, because there's something in the rental car," Arias suggested.
"Like what?"
"Maybe blood,"
she said matter-of-factly. "In the trunk? In the back seat? That's what we are going to look for, so..."
"I was thinking maybe the handle, the steering wheel, and things that get touched."
It appeared Arias was almost confessing when she alluded to the possibility that there might be blood in the rental car. But investigators were never able to recover any biological material to be used for the DNA test because the car had been cleaned by an employee after she returned it. She had also removed the floor mats before returning the car. Even though Arias continued to deny being in Mesa on the day of the murder, Flores began to premise his questions as if she had been. He asked her whether she'd been worried that Travis's roommates would find her there, how long she was in the house after it happened, why she threw the camera in the washing machine. "Do you remember those things?" he asked.
"No,"
Arias replied. They started to talk about the white Ford Focus that Arias had rented for the drive. The investigation into the car had determined that Arias had actually rejected the first car the rental company had given her, another Ford Focus, but a red one, and he wanted to find out more about it. "I know they were going to rent you another car, but then something happened with the first car. Either you didn't like it, or I don't know if it had problems." This was a detail that I considered important because it spoke to her planning. She claimed she hadn't wanted a red car because it would be more noticeable, akin to a red flag, that police were more likely to stop someone in a red car. But I suspected she chose a more neutral color to blend in. After discussing the fact that Travis had apparently canceled plans to see her at the end of May, Flores returned to his questions. "Did Travis know you were coming?" Flores watched for a reaction. "He knew?" he coaxed. "I saw you kind of shake your head a little bit."
"This is hard," Arias said, her voice cracking.
For the first time, she looked away from the detective, her gaze fixed to a point on the wall. It appeared she was trying to buy time to come up with her next line. "That's okay," he said, as he tried to coax her along, peppering her with questions. "Did he know you were coming? Did you guys talk on the phone? What was the discussion about? Did you guys talk when you were en route to Phoenix?" Arias's reply was barely audible.
"Yeah,"
she mumbled, looking down at her feet. And with that, she placed herself at the crime scene, finally succumbing to the evidence left behind in Travis's camera.
Just briefly. I told him my phone was dying, which was true. I thought I left my charger in Monterey. I really honestly thought I left my charger there, and I had been talking all day, just on the phone. I take a lot of pictures of myself.
She smiled. I noticed, Flores replied with a laugh, referring to several selfies police had found on her cell phone that had been taken during her recent trip.
I am kind of picky about it. I take like 20 and I am like, delete, 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 and I keep 2 or 3.
So he knew you were coming. He was expecting you? Arias did not respond, instead remaining quiet with her hands folded in her lap. Obviously, you guys had a little encounter. Is that when those pictures were taken? Flores asked, referring to the 6 photographs of their sexual rendezvous. Did he even show you those pictures?
This was the longest silence I had seen from Arias since the start of her 2-day-long interview. Unlike other times when she would close herself off in the fetal position or hide her face in her hands, this time she looked off toward the corner, apparently thinking about how much she was going to reveal and the style with which she was going to deliver the line. She'd already put herself at the house and was on the brink of having to explain what happened inside.
It's going to be all right, Jody.
I feel really powerless in here, she whimpered, appearing to finally realize that she was caught, and for the first time couldn't figure out how to explain that she'd been merely present at the crime scene but had not committed the crime. Her repeated requests to see the photographs had been denied, so she had been unable to craft a story based on the evidence police had gathered. Her only way out was to change the subject. The detective let enough time pass to demonstrate his concern before moving ahead with his inquiry. After talking to her about whether Travis's roommates were home when she arrived, Arias explained that she got in at 3 in the morning.
Did you guys spend all day together then? Did you go anywhere? Did you stay in the house?
Slept, Arias said.
Well, after a long trip, I would sleep too.
Arias recalled that when she got there, Travis was watching some stupid music video with people dancing with foil boxes on their heads. Suddenly, she grew animated, mimicking the characters' hand movements. She was speaking to Flores as if they were friends, sharing stories about a mutual acquaintance. It was weird. It was robotic kind of music. It's just like stupid, pointless stuff. Being as driven and deep as he is, it is just funny that he watches stuff like that. The detective laughed along, obviously hoping that this somewhat bonding experience would give her the impetus to share what really happened. He redirected her to the afternoon photographic session.
Is that when those were taken that day?
In a barely audible whisper, Arias shared with Flores something that he didn't know. We also made a video. And we deleted it.
On that camera?
On his camera,
Arias confirmed.
Her admission came as a surprise to me. She hadn't said much of anything up to that point, and now she was volunteering information that was not even known to the detective. I wondered what her motivation for this new disclosure was, and the only thing that seemed logical was that in her mind she and Flores were sharing a moment. It was clear to me now that her preoccupation with the photos was partially an effort to try to find out if their sex video had been recovered. If Flores was surprised by this revelation, he didn't show it.
Videos are hard to get when they are erased, he told her. They take up so much room, whereas pictures are a little different.
The video would not have offered any clues that the pictures hadn't already given him, so it was not surprising that he moved on to the bigger question of motive.
What happened after that? What went wrong? I know that the last photos of him were taken at 5:20, 5:30, and you said he doesn't like you to take pictures of him.
He was very private about the shower, Arias disclosed, and added that so was she.
Laughing, Flores asked, Is that why you were taking pictures of him in the shower, trying to get back at him?
Arias denied that was the reason.
I am surprised he allowed you to take pictures of him in the shower. The first few looked like he wasn't that comfortable, but obviously whatever you were saying to him appeared to make him a little more comfortable.
What went wrong? Did he say something to you?
Arias took several deep breaths and turned her face away as the detective pressed her for an answer.
Were you angry about something? Were you frustrated? What was it?
Her face was almost completely hidden behind strands of her long brown hair, but I could tell she was listening closely. It appeared she was weighing her options and had come to a place where she was finally ready to free herself of the tremendous burden she had been carrying around for the past month.
It looked as though she was about to say something when suddenly the sound of Flores's pager going off interrupted the pin-dropping silence.
16 seconds ticked by as Flores checked his phone and looked at the message. It appeared the short reprieve allowed her to collect herself enough to sit up in her chair, push her hair back away from her face, and take a breath as she waited for the detective's attention to return to her.
"What are you going to do with the rental car?"
she asked, immediately redirecting the focus of the questioning away from the precipitating incident to something completely unrelated.
"Are they going to bring it here?"
There were several photos of him, Flores continued, trying to return the conversation to the moments before the killing. But Arias was now focused on the present and the search of the rental car currently underway. I could feel Flores's frustration as he inhaled deeply and let out a sigh. Still, he did his best to bring Arias back to the scene in the bathroom.
There were several photos of him, and the last one is of him sitting in the shower. That's when I think it happened.
What did you do? What happened, Jody? We've come this far. Did you plan on doing that the whole time?
No, she answered, clearly disengaged as she began running her fingers through her hair and staring blankly as the staccato of Flores's questioning increased.
Then why? Tell me. I don't believe you planned it, he told her.
I was familiar with the interrogation technique Flores was now employing, where the officers are taught to minimize the suspect's involvement in hopes that they will admit something.
But then I don't understand why. Why you took a gun with you?
I didn't, Arias insisted.
Then where did you get it? Did you bring it with you? Did you get it there in Arizona?
I didn't have, actually, like, have it in my possession.
Then who had it? If you didn't have it and Travis didn't have it, then who had it?
Jody, Flores implored, please.
I can't, she said in her best B-actress angst.
Why not? Are you protecting somebody else? Why would somebody else do this?
I don't know.
Did someone catch you there? Someone not expecting you to be there?
Arias's reply was inaudible.
Then who was it?
I don't know,
she said, looking up at the ceiling and nervously pulling on her hand, likely trying to figure out which direction her story should pivot to next.
Okay, what do you remember from the time you were taking pictures and the time you left? What happened? What happened after that last picture was taken?
After they went back and forth, Flores finally began to push her.
If somebody else was there with you, we need to know that. Why would somebody do that just because you're there with Travis?
They didn't say, she replied.
For the first time, there was an answer. Not much, but something he could build off. He murmured.
They didn't say,
Arias repeated in a faint voice.
He didn't say?
They.
And with that, Arias had the beginnings of her second story. One in which she had been present for Travis's death, but it wasn't her committing the crime. It was they.
What was the first thing they did to him? You were there, you saw it.
Flores hoped that what Arias was about to tell him might actually be what happened, because it could be that two people had done this. If she were to give him names, it wouldn't be so implausible.
I actually didn't see it. I heard it first, Arias began.
Was there an argument?
Not between Travis and them.
Any argument between anybody?
Yeah.
She paused, patting tears from her eyes.
Is there any way I can see those pictures?
It was a telling moment of lucidity during a moment that at least superficially appeared emotional, and it was a strategy of hers that I would encounter later on. Even in the midst of crafting this new story, she had not lost sight of her true aim, the crime scene photos and how they could enable her to fabricate a story that matched the events depicted in the photographs. "No," he told her, "not right now."
"Can I see them soon?" she begged.
By this point, her request had morphed into a desperate plea. "You need to start letting me know what happened," Flores instructed her. "You are saying that other people were there. You know how much that concerns me?"
"I don't know. They know where I live, or they know where my parents are. I don't know if they know where my grandparents are. They know my address. They know where my family is,"
Arias contended, sobbing and wiping at her tears.
"Sorry."
"So you are trying to say you're doing this to protect your family? Why would somebody do this to you and to him?" Flores asked incredulously.
"I don't think they really intended to do anything to me."
"So you are saying somebody followed you all the way to Arizona from here?"
"I think I was an element of surprise for them."
"You were an element of surprise," Flores parroted, an air of frustrated disbelief in his tone.
"I am guessing."
"They didn't expect you to be there."
"I mean, they had to have seen my car."
"Is this someone who lives in Mesa locally?"
"I didn't recognize them."
"Well, you have to give me a motive," Flores told her. "Why would they do this? Were they going after Travis?" Arias collapsed onto the table, resting her head in the crook of her elbow. "You tell me this, but you give me no reason."
"They didn't discuss much,"
Arias said, popping back up to look at Flores.
"They just argued."
"About what?"
"About whether or not to kill me."
"For what reason?"
"Because I'm a witness."
"A witness to what?"
"Him. To Travis," Arias said, cupping her face in her hands.
"Travis's murder?"
"Yeah, but I didn't really witness it. I didn't see much,"
she said, hiding her face in her hands as if frightened at the recollection. "You need to make this believable, because this is not believable to me right now," Flores directed. "You need to give me something." Arias seemed eager to indulge the detective.
"Okay, just listen."
"Jody, I am listening, and it doesn't make any sense to me. People just don't go in somewhere and kill somebody for no reason and then let a witness go. That doesn't happen. They've already killed one person, why not just take care of the other?"
"You know who they are, if you are telling me the truth." "I don't know them."
"Then I don't believe you. I can't. You can't expect me to." As if to buy more time, Arias then launched into a long-winded rendition of the events of June 3rd, her first day on the road, beginning with her departure from Wairika and going through her arrival at Travis's house in the middle of the night. After arriving there, she said they slept in until about 1 p.m. The next day, June 4th, and almost immediately upon waking, they engaged in sexual interplay, which, as she told Flores earlier, included videotaping as well as photographs. At least this part of her story appeared to have been true, since the photographs from the camera confirmed them posing nude starting around 1:30 in the afternoon. She claimed afterward that they went downstairs to his study, where they tried to view some CDs that she had brought with her, containing pictures of various trips they had taken. But they were having problems because either the computer couldn't play them, or the CDs were damaged. It was around this time that they engaged in sex for a second time. She said they went back upstairs, where Travis shaved before he took a shower. As he stood in the shower, she convinced him to allow her to use his newly purchased camera to photograph him. She believed that the photograph of him with the water running down his face was a very nice image. That was where her story took a drastic detour, once again stretching the boundaries of credulity. As she knelt down outside of the shower reviewing the photos, she said she heard a pop, and almost simultaneously felt a strike to the back of her head, which she believed caused her to lapse into unconsciousness for a short period of time.
Upon regaining consciousness, she saw two attackers wearing ski masks, a man and a woman, one armed with a gun and one armed with a knife. She turned her attention to Travis and realized that he had been shot and was screaming and bleeding profusely. He told her to go to his neighbors and go get help. She did not follow his instruction because, she said, the attackers prevented her from leaving. According to her story, in the middle of this melee, the male attacker took the time to find her purse and rummage through it, looking to find her identification information. He found both her driver's license and car registration, which included her parents' address in Wairika. She was then told by the male attacker that she must be that bitch from California, leading her to believe they somehow knew her. She immediately became afraid for her family and decided to follow the attacker's instructions. After returning the registration and driver's license to her purse, the male attacker went through the pockets of her Levi's, which she claimed were in a backpack she had brought with her, and found $80, which he pocketed. According to her, the attack took a more serious turn when the female assailant tried to convince her companion that Arius should also be killed. But he prevailed, saying, "That's not why we are here." At some point, Arius claimed that she began to fight with the woman, who apparently was now holding the knife. Although Arius was barefoot and unarmed, she appeared to have escaped the encounter unharmed, with the exception of a cut to one of the fingers on her left hand. The attackers finally decided to let her leave with a stern warning, counseling against telling anyone what she had just lived through. They allowed her to take her purse and backpack and shoes and leave out the front door, apparently confident that their threats would silence her and stop her from calling police to aid a dying Travis. "You just left? You didn't run to the neighbors? You didn't try calling?" Flores asked with a tone of disbelief. "You knew they were in his house. You had time to run to the neighbor. Why didn't you do that?"
"I was really scared," Arius whined. "I was freaked out of my mind."
"I don't believe you," he responded in a raspy godfather-type voice, extending his left hand to emphasize his point. "I came in here hoping you would tell me the truth, and this is not the truth, Jody." After some final back and forth, Flores left the room, and the lined legal pad he had left behind on the table became the focus of her attention. Tearing three sheets from the pad, she folded them and stuck them in the chest pocket of her orange top. But when she looked down at them, she appeared to realize that they would be visible to anyone who entered the room. So she tucked them into the waistband of her orange pants, making sure her top was covering them. When Detective Blaney entered the room a few moments later, she asked if Arius had any paper. The police had been monitoring her from outside the room and saw what she'd done. Arius hesitated for a moment before lifting her top to reveal the hidden papers. Although Blaney ultimately allowed her to keep the items, her attempts to hide them showed she had no compunction about trying to get away with as much as she could, even if it was something as insignificant as three sheets of paper. Approximately 2 weeks later, Arius mailed a letter from the jail to Travis's grandmother, Norma Sarvey, who lived in Riverside, California. Interestingly enough, Arius listed the return address on the envelope as her parents' address on Oregon Street, although the jail's official address was stamped in black ink over her handwritten one.
"Of all the letters I must write, this is one of the most difficult, second only to the one I must write to my parents."
Arius began the 18-page handwritten letter, which was dated Monday, July 28, 2008, which would have been Travis's 31st birthday.
"I don't have all of the answers that you seek," the letter began, "but as I sit here today and put pen to paper, even on Travis's birthday, I'm going to try to answer as many as I can.
Since things have culminated in this way, and since the detectives have already made it clear that my case is hopeless and theirs rock solid, I have no reason to hold anything back at this point." She proceeded to provide a brief synopsis of the history of her relationship with Travis. I met Travis at the Rainforest Cafe at the MGM in September 2006. We later marveled and mused at the irony of meeting in such a place, as we later discovered our mutual passion for a healthy planet and the environment in general. He confidently walked right up to me, stuck out his right, and said, "Hi, I'm Travis." I cordially responded with the usual niceties and figured that would be it, since in that moment he was just another of the many new names I was trying not to forget. Arius claimed she didn't feel any sort of magnetic attraction to him, but also did not turn her back on his entreaties. Although she tried to meet and mingle with other people, he monopolized her attention by walking alongside her and keeping up a running conversation. In the short time they talked, they discovered they had a few things in common: traveling, the 49ers, the UFC, and the drive to create an amazing life. She said she didn't expect to hear from Travis again, but surprisingly, he called her the very next day. As she described it, the relationship was on a very fast track. Within days, he invited her to spend the weekend at the home of his friends, Sky and Chris Hughes, in Murrieta, California, one of the reasons being so that she could attend church with them, and the following Wednesday, he gave her a copy of the Book of Mormon. By November 2006, Travis was baptizing her as a Mormon at the church in Palm Desert, California. He said he'd never met anyone more prepared to receive the gospel, she wrote. She was very happy because she claimed joining the LDS church was one of the best decisions she ever made. I know that Travis will be richly rewarded for the role he played in bringing me into the fold. Arius explained that they were mutually attracted, but they were not officially dating. By Christmas of 2006, Travis had grown to mean a lot to her. For his part, he was determined to Mormonize her, so he gave her gifts to serve that purpose, including a CTR ring and scriptures with her name engraved on them, a painting of Jesus Christ, and a biography of Church President Gordon B. Hinckley. His generosity never wavered the entire time that I knew him, not once. Arius wrote in that same letter that on February 2, 2007, they began to officially date. Things went really well despite one small hang-up: Deanna Reed. Deanna Reed was one of Travis's former girlfriends, whom he had dated during two separate periods, and the two had remained very close friends. According to the letter, she and Travis even talked of marriage. This included discussions about baby names and the number and sexes of children they wanted. She believed this was a natural progression. According to her letter, in May 2007, Arius could no longer handle the mortgage of her home in Palm Desert, and she had to move out. Travis insisted that I move closer to him so that we could have a more normal relationship. Although he expressed concern for Deanna's reaction, saying that if she found out, it would be World War III. The two took a trip to Daniels Summit, Utah, in June 2007, and after their return, according to Arius, she did something completely dishonest. I acted on an impulse and a gut feeling. You see, I had been in a few relationships before when my partner was not being completely faithful, and there is a distinct feeling that comes with it. Travis had been interacting with some girls in my presence that gave me cause or concern. I knew he was a flirtatious type, and I had witnessed it on countless occasions prior to that point. I am not a jealous person, but something about the way he conducted himself at that time caused me to question his level of commitment to our relationship and to me. The dishonest deed that I had mentioned was that I looked at the text messages in his phone. I thought to myself, he said he had nothing to hide, so why not? A flawed logic, I know. I fully expected to find a few mild flirtations with other girls, as this was his M.O. anyway, and he was not secretive about it. What I found, however, was far more,
including several references made of the many separate intimate rendezvous he had with other girls, including plans in the making for further associations of the same kind. Arias said she attempted to verify that he had been dishonest by checking the dates, as she feared the activities that she'd uncovered had been during the time they had been dating, supposedly exclusively. But rather than confront Travis, she chose to go on vacation with him, and they traveled to Niagara Falls and the Sacred Grove in New York State, as well as to Huntington Beach, California. It was only after they returned from their trip that she spoke to him about her concerns. Although he was very apologetic, she found there was no way she could forgive him. So she broke up with him on June 29, 2007, because she could not trust him.
"This was a very difficult decision for me because I loved him very much. It was especially difficult because he begged me to marry him that same day. Up to that point, a proposal was expected at any time, but once the trust is gone, it is hopeless."
In July 2007, Arias wrote, she decided to move to Mesa after Travis persuaded her to make the move, reiterating the story she'd told Flores. She used to wonder what it would have been like to accept his marriage proposal, but she didn't think things would have changed, because a month before she moved back to California, in April of 2008, she and Travis had a conversation about previous relationships, and he confessed that most of the time that she'd been living in Mesa, he'd been dating Lisa Andrews. She had asked him about it, and he had lied by telling her he wasn't dating anyone. She said she'd never had a reason not to believe him, so she couldn't understand why he hid it from her, since she was not the type to have a crying, emotional meltdown over something like that. She would have been happy for him. The shock that she experienced was related not to the fact that he had lied again, not that he cheated on yet another girlfriend, but that this time she was the other woman, and it made her feel ashamed. Arias claimed her first thought was not of herself, but of poor Lisa. She said she even thought about telling her, but decided that it would destroy her relationship with Travis and cause a lot of unnecessary drama and pain. According to Arias, when it was her turn to come clean, his attitude changed and all hell broke loose. He lost his temper completely and flew into a rage. He began punching himself in the head so hard that he injured his neck and his back and could barely turn his head from side to side. She even claimed that he beat her on two separate occasions, but she never told anyone about it because he was not her partner any longer, and besides, it would be a matter of days before she rolled out of town in a U-Haul truck. "I know you all probably hate me even more than before you started reading this letter," Arias wrote on page 8 of the 18-page attempt to exonerate herself in the eyes of Travis's grandmother. "Well, hang on, because the plot thickens, and by the time you're done reading this, you most likely won't consider me worthy of your own spit." She went on to describe Travis's killing in the same fashion as she did to Detective Flores, with a few embellishments. In this version, the male assailant held the gun to my head and tried to fire, but nothing happened. Just a click. She also detailed a scuffle with the female attacker, who she claimed came at her with a knife, and during the struggle, stomped on her bare feet. "I didn't notice the pain. Maybe it was adrenaline, but my left foot was later throbbing and bruised, so I know she got me at least once, probably more on that foot. And she had caused two of the toenails on my other foot to bleed, which I didn't discover until later as well." She also claimed that she felt awful because she hadn't looked before backing out of the driveway as she fled the scene. "I probably should have never been driving in that kind of state." Her seemingly heartfelt letter sent to Travis's grandmother, supposedly offering solace, appeared more like a taunt as she described a scenario that was impossible to believe. Chapter 8.
Almost 2 years after Travis's murder, the case should have been ready to go to trial according to the timeline set out in the Arizona Rules of Criminal Procedure. The police reports had been reviewed, witness interviews were underway, and Jodi Arias's version of events had been consistent ever since she told Flores that she had merely been present when two strangers broke in and killed Travis. But in spring 2010, the defense began to shift in ways that would permanently alter the makeup and tone of this case. These changes had actually started to take root in August 2009, when Arias's initial court-appointed counsel was allowed to withdraw. And a second set of attorneys, also appointed by the court, took over the defense. Lawrence Nurmi was assigned as lead attorney, with Victoria Washington assisting him. I didn't know much about either attorney, our paths had never crossed before, but I understood that Nurmi was qualified to represent defendants charged with a capital crime. On the face of it, the presence of these new attorneys wasn't particularly significant because my interactions with Arias's defense team were fairly limited. As is standard, the only time I would usually see them was during our periodic status conferences, which occurred every 30 to 45 days. During these appearances, the prosecution and defense were asked to update the judge on their progress and alert the court to any problems that had arisen. In these conferences, neither side is required to disclose details of the approach or tactics they intend to use, enabling the prosecutor and defense counsel to pursue avenues that best advance their cause without having to tip their hand. But with the arrival of these new attorneys came new requests. The prosecution is required to provide defense counsel copies of police reports, photographs, and other documentary items. Over the course of this prosecution, more than 2,400 pages of documents alone were provided to defense counsel. The state is also required to list the names and addresses of those it expects to testify at trial. Defense counsel has a similar duty to disclose the claims that will be advanced at trial, along with the names of persons who may be called to testify for their side. Their disclosure obligation includes providing the state with copies of any materials that they think are important and might be used at trial. In April 2010, Arias's defense counsel requested that the prosecution provide text messages from Travis's cell phone and instant messages and emails from his computer. The production of this electronic correspondence proved problematic for different reasons. Technology had not advanced sufficiently to allow recovery of the text messages without making it unduly burdensome and extremely time-consuming. As for the instant messages and email, the service provider, in this case Google, had ignored the subpoena I sent requesting the correspondence. Eventually, each of these issues was resolved once the electronic correspondence was made available to the prosecution, allowing for copies to be made and turned over to the defense. The state provided defense counsel with thousands of texts, emails, and instant messages from Travis's various accounts. It was a massive trove of information, with the messages and emails covering everything from the mundane to the inflammatory. What emerged was a portrait of a tumultuous relationship, one laced with sexual overtones and bad feelings on both sides. The instant messages were particularly troublesome because they portrayed Travis as someone who may have verbally crossed the line of good taste, as he and Arias argued via electronic means. In one angry instant messenger chat between the two, on May 26, 2008, Travis complained that Arias was nothing but a liar from the beginning. It was clear that she had done something to upset him greatly, but that catalyst wasn't discernible from the lengthy exchange. What was clear was that Travis felt that she had lied to him. "Travis, you have not felt as much pain in all your life than what you have repeatedly caused me with your lies and your invasions and the psycho shit you have subjected me to. Travis, you have made me want to die. Travis, on countless occasions, you have hurt me so bad over and over again. And how do you repay me for giving you by doing the same thing? Couldn't you ever try to love me? You only showed that you hated me.
Never love. Only hate. Your words were lies. Can't you just tell the truth? Throughout the entire exchange that followed, Arius avoided answering Travis's ongoing requests for the truth. Instead, she portrayed herself as the victim, writing, "Jody, there have been times when you've screamed into the phone so loud at me that the speaker was distorted, and then you hung up. The pain was so sharp and so deep that I just couldn't process it. I could only scream in response to the air, and I would scream at the top of my lungs until my throat was raw, 'I hate you, I hate you, I hate you,' until I had no energy left to say it, and it had whittled down to a little wimp, 'I hate you.' And I just sobbed and cried until I couldn't breathe. Jody, but you know what? I deserved all of that. Every angry phone call, every unpleasant word. Jody, doesn't compare to what I've put you through." The conversation continued with Travis attempting to get Arius to admit that she had slashed his tires. He also accused her of stealing his journals. At one point, Travis's frustration with Arius's refusal to take responsibility was boiling over when he said, "Write something, you stupid idiot!" Arius picked this moment to respond, "I may be a liar, I may be a whore, I may be evil, I may be a coward, I may not be worth the air I breathe. I am most like the most horrible person you've ever had the misfortune of knowing, but one thing I am not is violent. I did not and would never slash your tires." This appears to infuriate Travis, who again demands that Arius tell the truth. The heated exchange continues for several more pages until his anger finally boils over and he lashes out in derogatory fashion, calling her a three-hole wonder. The first time I read those words, I realized that they were extremely harsh, so I went back to the beginning of this section of the conversation to understand the context of the remark. The way this conversation had been reproduced required it be read from the bottom of the page to the top, rather than the customary top to bottom. This time I read the conversation from top to bottom rather than the way I had been reading it before. I wanted to make sure that I hadn't been mistaken, that Travis had actually referred to Arius in this way. Either way I read it, it brought me to the same uncomfortable place. While I understood from the conversation that Travis had made the comment in anger, it felt inappropriate under any circumstance because it was so derogatory. Even if they were talking in a sexual context, and even if Arius prompted the comment by saying she was a whore, it still didn't lessen its impact. It was the kind of comment that could shape a jury's opinion and garner sympathy for Arius. I took solace in the belief that this comment would probably not be admissible at trial because it was hearsay and would unfairly go into an area of Travis's character that had nothing to do with the killing. Up to this point, Arius was still maintaining that Travis had been killed by two intruders as he posed for pictures in the shower, so his being verbally abusive to Arius was irrelevant to the reason he was murdered. In the same conversation, Travis also indicated that he felt he was meaningless to her, writing that he was little more than a dildo with a heartbeat to you. It seemed that Travis had very conflicted feelings about his sexual relationship with Arius and believed that she had been using him for her sexual gratification. Arius was no shrinking violet and pushed the sexual envelope by sending Travis explicit text messages encouraging the sexual interaction between the two. She sent the following on February 25th, 2008.
"The things I had to do today consisted of waxing my pussy so it was nice and smooth, just in case, showering so I was fresh and clean for you."
Arius sent other text messages along the same lines in January and February 2008.
"Will do. The reason I was asking about later tonight is because I want to give you a nice BJ, and I'd like a generous facial in return. What do you say?" "Oh my gosh, that is so freaking hot, I want to lick it up and then sit on it. You are so tasty. My goodness. Oh yes, I want to fuck you like a dirty, horny little schoolgirl.
Although Arius may have been a willing participant in their sexual repartee, defense counsel's inordinate interest in Travis's texts, instant messages, and emails hinted that they might be contemplating a change in strategy and moving away from the story that Arius had been alleging for the nearly 2 years since her arrest. Another change in her story would be risky because it would contradict both her allegations to Flores that two masked intruders killed Travis and the tale she'd told during interviews with two national television news magazines, in which she said the same thing, tying herself to that fantastical rendition of events. One of the TV interviews had actually occurred in Yreka less than a month after she was taken into custody, when she had granted a jailhouse interview to 48 hours. She then did a follow-up interview at that same news show in September 2008, after her extradition to Phoenix. She also spoke to Inside Edition around the same time as the second interview with 48 Hours. Her interview with Inside Edition aired first. Arius, dressed in black and white striped jail garb, her long brown hair neatly brushed and falling over her shoulders, smiled demurely as she emphatically proclaimed her guiltlessness.
"I know that I am innocent. God knows that I'm innocent. Travis knows I'm innocent. I absolutely did not kill Travis Alexander. I had nothing to do with his murder. I didn't harm him in any way."
She again went on to tell the story of two assailants who entered Travis's home and
attacked us both. In a nutshell, two people took Travis's life. Two monsters, she claimed, her voice never higher than a raised whisper.
As believable as her denials may have sounded, what was most compelling about this interview was her indignation.
"No jury is going to convict me," she said with certainty.
She then followed up this statement with an even more emphatic one.
"Because I'm innocent. You can mark my words on that one."
The interview with 48 Hours aired some months later, and it was telling for totally different reasons. When asked about her childhood, Arius described an idyllic upbringing and maintained that she and her parents and siblings were very close. I couldn't help but think back to the interviews Detective Flores had conducted with Sandy and Bill Arius and how they had described a secretive, disrespectful daughter who had been shutting them out of her life since she was 14. As far as I was concerned, here was yet another indication that she would make things up if it suited her, even under inconsequential circumstances such as a media interview. More importantly, though, she had made it difficult to present a story of an abusive childhood as a possible excuse for her behavior, or to help understand the killing, because she had told a national audience something contrary to what Bill and Sandy had expressed to police. Her statements had served to effectively preclude her parents from testifying at trial, because the idyllic family portrait she had just painted for the television audience was in stark contrast to the statements her parents had made to police about her inability to get along with her mother and being extremely secretive. When it came to the murder of Travis Alexander, Arius stuck to her story, continuing to adamantly deny any plans to visit Travis in Arizona on that fateful day. She again recited her masked intruder story, making sure it was consistent with the one given to Detective Flores and to Inside Edition. In addition to the incredible nature of the story itself, her failure to alert police immediately or to tell them about the two intruders during her first interviews with Detective Flores continued to stand out as problematic. It sounded more like a slip of the tongue than a reason when she told the interviewer she hadn't called the police because she didn't want to implicate herself. The highlight of the 48 Hours interview was the assertion that she intended to take the witness stand and testify at trial. That told me that she was confident in her public speaking abilities and that she believed she was persuasive enough to make the charges go away just by telling her story. She was masterful in front of the camera, playing the part of someone who couldn't have committed this murder. The way she could look straight at the camera lens and answer the interviewer's questions with apparent sincerity was impressive.
She clearly wasn't going to be intimidated.
"I don't believe that I am going to be convicted," she confidently told 48 Hours' Maureen Maher, just as she had advised the interviewer from Inside Edition. "I don't think that I'm going to spend one day in prison."
While she hadn't given another interview in the almost two-year span since these aired, her initial decision to tell her story to the media had elevated both the case and her account to mythical heights. It was one thing to concoct this kind of narrative when confronted with overwhelming evidence during a police interview, but quite another to volunteer those same claims to a national audience. The account of the masked intruders had become synonymous with the case. Perhaps the feedback from Arias's TV interviews, which called into question the believability of her story, led her and her defense counsel to rethink their approach in defending the case. Even though no notice of a change in defense had yet been filed with the court, I could see that one was in the offing. The graphic and hurtful nature of the text messages, IM chats, and emails had the potential to taint Travis's reputation and character, which would only be relevant if Arias changed her existing story. It didn't take much to foresee that defense counsel were considering self-defense as an option. Pleading self-defense would allow Arias to say that Travis was such a bad person, he deserved what she doled out to him on June 4, 2008. It appeared from their requests for the electronic correspondence that defense counsel was motivated by their intent to use Travis's words to cast him into the role of villain, a role they would insist he play. And Arias was being recast as a victim, a role she'd sought as hers from the beginning of the case. In June 2010, not long after the email and text messages were made available, defense counsel made an unexpected disclosure to me. It was printouts of 10 letters they had received via email on Sunday, April 11, 2010, from someone with an email address identifying himself as Bob White. Accompanying the letters was a single sentence written by White, ostensibly seeking to distance himself from the case. "I came across these, but don't want to be involved." As indicated in the public filings, each of the letters attached to the email was supposedly written by Travis, where he mentions sexual acts and fantasies and admits conduct that would be considered deviant or unlawful. By order of the court, the content of the letters was sealed on July 15, 2010. Anyone can create an email account under a fictitious name, and it seemed that was the case in this instance, because Bob White was never identified beyond the name provided on the electronic correspondence. Even more suspect was that the whereabouts of the original letters was never disclosed by defense counsel. The method in which they came to light and the fact that the letters were not originals immediately raised a red flag and signaled that an investigation into their authenticity was in order. 3 weeks after the disclosure of the Bob White letters, defense counsel advised me through a notice of defenses filed with the court that they would now pursue a justification defense related to domestic violence, commonly known as self-defense. Despite previously claiming she either hadn't been at the scene or that the killing was committed by intruders, Arias was changing her story again and now admitting that she had killed Travis and had done so for a justifiable reason. In her latest version of events, Travis became angry and attacked her, making her fear for her life because she dropped his camera while she took pictures of him in the shower. She admitted that no one else had been in the bathroom with them, contrary to what she had told Detective Flores back on July 16, 2008, when he interviewed her in Wairika. Arias was also claiming that on several occasions, Travis sexually and physically abused her and had slapped her and choked her. This was in sharp contrast to the Travis Alexander she had previously described to Detective Flores during their telephone conversations and her face-to-face interviews with him. Changing stories would normally be the death knell for a defendant because any testimony with inconsistent stories would surely be rejected by a jury.
except that Jodi Ann Arias was different in her physical appearance, effect, and demeanor, and was skilled at making the implausible seem true. Any questioning of her would be extremely difficult because, as I had seen in her interviews and phone calls, she could seamlessly meld the truth with her untruths, making her statements seem consistent. Getting at the truth in court would be especially difficult because there were just two people present in Travis's bedroom on June 4, 2008, and only one of them, Jodi Arias, was alive to tell her story. The challenge was all the more daunting because it included discrediting her assertion that Travis was a cad who hit her at times and spoke to her in a demeaning tone, as illustrated by some of the text messages and instant messenger conversations now available. The clanging of his three-hole wonder comment in particular reverberated loudly, as it provided support for her allegation that Travis was abusive, making for what appeared to be an almost insurmountable hurdle. Given the damning electronic conversation, I had to admit that Arias's self-defense claim seemed to have a chance of succeeding. Providence seemed to have miraculously come to her aid through these 10 letters purportedly written by Travis, and it was no coincidence that her claim of self-defense arose shortly after her defense counsel received Bob White's email containing the prejudicial letters. If they could be authenticated and the acts described within them proven to be true, I knew they would present a nearly impossible hurdle to clear at trial. Jurors might even acquit Arias in reaching their verdict if they believed Travis was a reprehensible individual who had been abusing her. Chapter 9. People would be amazed at the stories I hear in this job. Everything from situational amnesia, where the accused claims he or she cannot remember anything about the crime, to denying his or her presence at the crime scene when there are pictures or video to prove otherwise. It is never easy to tell when a person is telling the truth, and the task becomes even more difficult when the individual has nothing to lose and everything to gain by being deceitful. Jodi Arias' filing with the court, announcing her new strategy, left me with little recourse but to go back and re-examine the police investigation more closely, as well as review any other information I might not have previously read. I had already amassed a voluminous amount of material, more than in any other case I could remember. Nearly a dozen three-ring binders full of investigative materials, file folders stuffed with photographs and documents, and stacks of miscellaneous papers crowded the bookcases that spanned nearly an entire wall of my small office. A quick re-examination of the police materials yielded no evidence of any claim of domestic abuse, other than her expressed disappointment to Detective Flores at learning that Travis had been communicating with other women during their relationship. She had offered nothing but compliments and praise for the man she was now claiming had abused and terrorized her. While it contradicted her current claims, this alone would not be enough to discount her assertions. I needed to find some concrete proof that I could hold up in front of a jury to repudiate her allegations. Everything the Mesa Police Department had done in their investigation had focused on placing Arias at the scene of the crime and proving she had been the one who killed Travis. With her change in strategy, she was effectively sticking her tongue out at them, negating the importance of the evidence they had already collected and presenting me with a wholly different task. Nothing in the photographs, police reports, or countless other documents addressed the issue of self-defense, so much of the investigative material was now of little use to me. A sense of alarm began to take hold. Standing before the bookcases in my office, I slowly recited the labels on the black binders lining the shelves. Photographs, cell phone records, text messages, Arias's statements. It felt as though I were standing on a lunar landscape pockmarked with gaping craters, having been shipwrecked there with no way of returning back to Earth.
My concern over the state of the case was compounded by my knowledge of how well Arias had handled herself when faced with incontrovertible evidence and pointed questions. I had spent hours studying the interviews she had done with Detective Flores at police headquarters in Yreka, and I had reviewed the raw footage of her stellar performances during her two jailhouse interviews with 48 Hours. Even though the story she was now telling was different from the one she'd told on those previous occasions, she was quite good at playing the victim. I started by revisiting everything the police had done, trying to identify avenues that could possibly have been explored had the investigation not been so duly focused on proving that Arias was the killer. I knew this was counterproductive, so I took a few hours out of the office, hoping that something I hadn't yet thought of would crystallize. Upon my return, I found myself back in front of the bookcases once again. Placing some of the binders I had already skimmed back onto the bookcase, I noticed a large manila envelope inside an accordion folder on the second shelf. Inside were more than 300 pages of background material that had been provided to me by Arias's first defense team months earlier as part of the discovery process. Because these reports were intended as an argument for why Arias should be shown leniency if faced with the death penalty, I hadn't reviewed them in detail, but had merely browsed them. Typically, I don't review in depth anything for the sentencing phase of the trial this early in the proceedings while I'm preparing for the guilt phase. But the vulnerability of the case as it currently stood compelled me to take a closer look. The materials included Arias's work and educational histories, dozens of photographs, and interviews with family members, a friend, and two ex-boyfriends. All of the interviews had been conducted between October 23, 2008, and April 26, 2009, by an investigator working on Arias's behalf, and were sent to me in summary form, so I couldn't read the actual text of the discussions. If the interviews had been recorded, I hadn't been provided with any of the audio tapes. As this material had been assembled to illustrate why Arias didn't deserve the death penalty, I was aware that it was meant to present her in the best possible light, so I didn't expect to find much that would be helpful.